another episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts, just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I am Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader. And we have a special guest with us today, a gentleman who has a place in Marvel Cinematic Universe history, I suppose. We'll be talking about that. Actor Marek Orevec appears in this minute of the movie. And welcome, Marek.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Very happy to have you. And Hal, tell us about this minute.
Well, you'll all be relieved to know there's not much dialogue in this minute. Minute five, a Hydra tank smashes through the church wall, reducing it to rubble. Jan falls, lifeless, as Johann Schmidt rolls up in his massive car, its engine growling. A Hydra lieutenant, barking orders to soldiers surrounding a stone coffin, shouts, "Open it! Quickly! Before he..." And Schmidt strides in, his towering figure casting a menacing shadow across the room.
Wow.
Beautifully done, Hal.
Yes.
Well, say it like you mean it, Brian.
Marek, thanks for being a part of our show. I'm sorry that we didn't have you on the previous minute. We had Billy Campbell, the Rocketeer, come on to talk about living in Norway. So we didn't get to talk about a lot of Norwegian. And unfortunately, this particular minute just shows your demise. So hey,
it can only go up from here.
Yeah.
But as you noted in some of your emails to Marek, Jim, Marek is the first person killed by Hydra in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, if I'm correct.
Yeah, so that's definitely
ta-da!
a piece of immortality.
What a distinction.
What a claim to fame to have.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Wow. Well, Marek, tell us a little bit about, what we're always interested in is the start of everything. When did you first become part of the cinematic universe? What was the first call like from your agent or wherever it was coming from?
It was in 2010. I believe we filmed in October, but the audition was already in, I remember it was summertime, and it was all very top secret, you know, hush, hush, no one must know what it is, and you know, you have to sign NDAs and meet someone handcuffed to a suitcase in a coffee shop in central London, and then they give you the script and you can read it, and then you have to hand it back, and it was really cool. But yeah, it was 2010, and I think I had a recall as well, and then I got it. And then found myself in Shepperton Studios.
Wow, and there you are acting against David Bradley and and Hugo Weaving. You get run over by Hugo Weaving's henchman. But was this at the time? Was this your biggest production that you had been in?
Yes, it was. Well, I mean, yes and no. I mean, yes, in terms of I'm still in that movie. Yes. The biggest production to that day had been Valkyrie with Tom Cruise.
Right.
But sadly, a lot of things went wrong there. And for me, especially. And I didn't make the final cut, as it were.
Did you find that out before the movie came out? You didn't take your mom and dad and, we're going to Valkyrie. Look for me.
No. It was actually, it was really unfortunate because we were filming. I had a week already done in filming in Berlin for a week. And it was kind of the second part of my part. I was a young lieutenant and I had the opening sequence with Tom Cruise driving him around through the desert, and then the Allies come and bomb us in North Africa, and big battle sequence, blackout. He wakes up in hospital without his, you know, eye and fingers missing and everything, and then he goes to the main room where all the wounded soldiers are and starts distributing medals on his soldiers on their beds, and sees me in coma, sort of half dead, and we ever seen together. So we filmed that, and the big battle opening was meant to be filmed in Jordan, I believe, a couple of months later in September. But many things went sort of wrong in Berlin, and they still, accidents happened, footage got over-illuminated, and they found themselves still in Berlin by Christmas. And then from what I remember, it was they at some point contemplated not, everyone had to go on different movies, do other things, and from what I remember, they were contemplating at some point to chop the action sequence altogether. But then, I think it was Paula Wagner and Tom Cruise had just taken over United Artists, and MGM was saying you have to have an action opening because Lions for Lambs didn't have any. Your first film didn't have any action, and I think that's what they wanted, so in the end, they did it, I think, in May 2008, nearly a year after we'd filmed my, the thing in Berlin, in Nevada. And of course, I don't have a green card, and for that kind of a part, they don't issue O-1 visas or whatever they're called. And I'd been waiting for the phone to ring for nearly a year. To continue my journey, but it
Sadly.
didn't, sadly. So yes and no, is the answer.
It must, I mean, I guess it was a relief that, here's a movie that you're going to be in now. I mean, a big tent pole movie. And so what was it like your first day on the set? Do you remember the initial filming going in? I mean, I think it was like half green screen and half practical sets.
I don't. Do you know what I remember? I remember it wasn't the first day of filming, but I remember we were on set, and I met David Bradley, and he was a lovely, lovely man. I remember we had lots of wonderful, wonderful conversations, and I remember Joe Johnston coming over to us and saying, "Guys, you know what'd be really cool? If you would do the dialogue in motion." Both David and I looked at each other, and we both thought the same thing. We don't speak Norwegian,
Yeah, welcome to the club.
and then he said, "Yeah, I know, but we're just get a voice coach and and get you to learn the lines in Norwegian." So we did, and a few days later, we found ourselves on set doing the entire thing in Norwegian, which was probably an offense to many Norwegian natives.
That's wonderful. I had a question about the set as well, because for me, it's very impressive how that giant tank smashes through the wall. And I'm wondering how much of that was practical. Did you see any of that? Was did a fake wall fall down on top of you? Were you there for that?
No, that was all. That was all. There were some, one of those sort of foam kind of blocks colored in sandstone color, whatever it was. There were a couple of those sort of landing, but not even on me, just next to me. And the rest was all green screen. And then also at some point, I think, this is 15 years ago, but I think there was a stunt double as well, in one of the things involved.
And then it looks like for your close-up, they were probably must have just placed some of the foam on you so that we could move those out of the way. And then here's the reveal of your
Exactly, there was one
tragically
being sort of taken
deceased.
on my head, and there was still looking very good.
What I really want to know is, was there a giant tank on the set? And it sounds like there was not.
That's really what
No,
we're
there
leading
wasn't.
up to.
There
Now,
wasn't. No.
disappointing, sadly.
Behind the curtain.
I have to say, we've talked so many times with Joe Johnston, and you are the first person to actually mention Joe mentioning something to the actors about what he'd like to see on the screen. Because what we usually hear about Joe's directing style is that he has everything going, and then if he only mentions anything if he wants to change something. So you actually heard a change, which is a rarity for Joe.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah,
Does he? Okay.
he normally he'll just sit back and say cut or things like that, but he doesn't. And I think Hal, do you remember, was it Billy Campbell who said that he was always looking to Joe to see what the what was it that okay, or am I not doing it well enough?
Yeah, I think when we talked with Billy about that, it was certainly towards the early part of the shoot for The Rocketeer, and you know, just talking about how some directors sort of no news is good news. And if they don't say anything, just keep doing it. I think that was the message Billy took away from that. And then, of course, when he does come out with direction, Merrick, it's just do something impossible, like deliver these lines in a language you don't speak. Exactly. So that's extremely helpful.
Yeah,
it's fantastic, though, because it plays well.
Yeah, it was nice to have because it was, you know, still quite sort of junior. It was nice to have someone like David Bradley being in the same, you know, situation and just sort of looking at us, you know, looking at me thinking, okay. it was a fun experience.
Wow. Now, I guess from October, or you were saying you were shooting this like October, November area, and then it would premiere the next summer, early summer when this came out. So, and all during that time, you probably couldn't talk about the movie or what you had seen and things. So was it hard keeping it hush hush until the premiere, or?
And also, you know, it was the very first one, wasn't it, of the Marvel sort of
it was the one right after Iron Man, because Iron Man was kind of like a standalone.
And it was very early though. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. The MCU was, you know, didn't exist as we know it today. It was all kind of, okay, you know, comic book adaptation. We knew about Spider-Man and Batman back then. I think that's, you know, that was about it.
Yeah.
And So it was the start of, I don't think anyone had, I certainly had no idea what, you know, the MCU was going to turn into.
You mentioned... Man
wouldn't have died, you know?
Yeah.
You could have had your own miniseries.
Crawl out from under the rocks going, wait a minute. You could have a grudge against Red Skull and join the Howling Commandos.
Well, so, to that point, you mentioned earlier reading the script under lock and key and so forth. But my understanding is that at least later on, they were so security conscious that actors, even Scarlett Johansson and, you know, the main actors, didn't get the whole script. They'd get their sides with their parts and their lines. But even they had really no idea what was happening in the movie. Did you get the script for the whole movie?
No, I didn't. And it was me being a bit sort of facetious, I think, you know, because I had been in a situation where I literally was, there was one guy, like a security man with the script in his suitcase, in his little sort of, you know, office suitcase. And he was waiting next to me in a coffee shop in Soho while I was reading it, which was the most bizarre. But that was not this one. And for this one, in a more direct answer to your question, I only was given my side, so I had no idea what the rest of the film was about. Yeah,
it would have been funny if the entire thing was written in Norwegian and they handed it to you. Now learn these.
It was like there was sort of this working title, Frostbite, I think it was called. You know, and I thought it's a Second World War film when I first read the script, because I had only my two or three pages, and that was it.
Well, you were mostly correct.
Right. Well, that's true. So when, at what point in this whole process did it become clear that this was something bigger than a potential, you know, period piece World War II film?
Well, I mean, I knew, I don't know exactly at what point, but I knew because, you know, I mean, the agent tells you,
wink, wink, nudge, nudge, a lot of that going on.
I think you always know when you have to sign stuff, and it, especially 15 years ago, it was more rare than it is now. You know, now you sign NDAs for a lot of things. But back 15 years ago, it was quite sort of, okay, this is big.
Yeah, you'd see guys walking away with red, white, and blue shields. It's kind of like a clue in the background. I was wondering, when you did your audition, was this back in the day when you were actually doing it live, or were you sending in a tape? Do you remember?
It was live, yeah.
It was live.
It was Priscilla John, I remember, was casting me, and it was live, yeah.
Wow. Do you remember were they similar lines that you had in the movie that
they were the same lines, just a different language.
Have you had any response from Norwegians about how accurate your pronunciation was?
I haven't actually.
You don't want that, probably.
Maybe not.
Let's just all safely assume that it was unanimously well received.
Yes.
Because if you were going to get any response, it would be complaints.
Yeah, the embassy hasn't called, so it's fine. It's I know in a later episode, we record all of these things out of order, so I'm not being prescient. But in a later episode, we're going to talk with the fellow that played Hitler on stage in the Captain America stage show. And he's kind of turned it into a cottage industry about going to schools and things and telling about being a part of Captain America and what it's like. And he was also in the Harry Potter movie, so he talks about being in Harry Potter and being an actor. Have you ever been approached in any of the comic book conventions to be a part of the Comic-Con world? I mean,
No, I haven't.
Well, Brian, you're gonna have to talk to some people about that.
I have connections, yeah. They'd love to have you, but
Yeah, get us in.
Yeah,
as they say, you need the 8-episode miniseries, yeah.
yeah, that
Yes. The further adventures of Jan.
Well, it's a lovely little role. I mean, how do you feel about it in retrospect? Was it just a week's work to you, or
No, I
what's
mean,
your feelings about it?
but it was a huge stepping stone. I mean, being part of this, it's just so I'm just so grateful and proud to be part of this. Again, 15 years ago, no one knew what the MCU is going to be 15 years later. So it's such a, I believe, really lovely thing on my CV as well, which helped me further in the following years. It was such a great experience. I mean, acting wise, it's not Hamlet, it is what it is. But it's a lovely little part in an amazing project. So I'm super grateful for it,
You're here.
Wonderful.
I've always
What do you?
wondered at the be if you're in the beginning of the movie for 30 seconds, when your scene is over, do you turn to the people that you're with, go, well, okay, we can go now, or
Yeah.
hopefully you stay, or actually, I guess you'd stay for the credits so you can point as it scrolls up and say, there.
There's my name.
Well, I don't mean to derail anything. Jim, edit this around if you need to, but I'd love to hear some about your that CV you mentioned. What's your origin story? And I understand you're working on something at the National Theatre in London now. What do you what's your story?
Sorry, what do you mean, origin
What's
story?
your well, yeah, how did you begin acting? Are you primarily a theater actor, a film actor? Have you done television?
I started when I was I think about 8 years old in primary school, and I loved it. I really, really loved it. I don't know why, but now when you're sort of older, when you're an adult, you look sort of back and what is your origin? What is your motivation to be an actor? It's a weird industry, a weird job to want to do. But in the end of the day, I think because of my sort of heritage, and I mentioned earlier, coming to Austria when I was a child, and I was in this new weird environment. Parents were sort of new-ish half of it, I guess it was. Today, I think, like, maybe it was a part of sort of looking for identity, looking for to identify myself with other people, and I found it really interesting. Maybe the parents were quite artistic. My father was a painter and artist, my real father. My mother, a ballet dancer. There was quite maybe just a streak in me as well from inherited from them. But I did that, and I did it all my youth, and then secondary school, no, because I remember the drama department was horrible, and I didn't get anyone then. And then I was a bit sort of lost. I dropped out of school when I was 15. I worked in a steel factory for a year. I sort of tried to find my thing. Then I went to engineering school because friends of mine were there. And then after a year, I dropped out of that because I just didn't want to do that. And the acting came back when I was 17, and I applied to the conservatoire in Vienna, and I got accepted as the youngest ever pupil, which was lovely. I did my I graduated from there when I was 21, and then I had the chance to train at Drama Centre in London, which is a very famous acting school, or was. It doesn't exist anymore, but it was a brilliant method school, which is something I really wanted to do, to learn the method, because Vienna was quite sort of classical. And also I was inspired by international movies when I was a child, and I always wanted to sort of break out of Austria, which back then had two TV channels and very, it was very small, and I wanted to sort of break out and go to the US or just work internationally, and London seemed not too far away. It was way before Brexit as well. It was quite easy. I just needed to book a flight and could study here with no questions asked. But yeah.
Wow, and I know you did a lot of Shakespeare work with when you were in the drama school. Was the entry into broadcast through film or through television? Where did that wind out?
I did a lot of theatre back in Austria, and then I came to the UK in 2005, and then I did I started when I after I graduated. First of all, I worked in a restaurant for 8 months, like every actor,
Yes.
and then I slowly started getting jobs, and I did a couple of TV things, and then I did a couple of sort of fringe theatre projects, And then suddenly, boom, I landed this Tom Cruise movie, which was amazing. I was 22 years old, and I was filming with Maverick, and it was insane. And then, things started happening. Other jobs came, TV jobs. But the agents, I think, also back in the day, they always said, I mean, we all know why. The money's better in film and television than it is in theatre. So, they saw me more succeeding in film and television, especially as a sort of foreign actor playing the Norwegian, etc.
Sure. Yeah.
I assume with your background, you speak several languages. Which ones?
Well, my Czech or Slovak is on a sort of sort of beginner's level, I would say, because I never went to school or never learned how to read or write, but I speak it with my mother, albeit with a very restricted vocabulary, and my grammar is perhaps nothing to be proud of, but I get by, and I can communicate, and I can understand, and because the Slavic languages are quite all share the same roots, I do understand quite a bit of Russian and Ukrainian and Polish, and all the Slavic languages are quite similar, which has been really useful in my career, actually. And I part of Drama Center, actually, they sent me to Russia for a couple of months to train at the Vakhtangov Institute, the Shukinskaya, which of course, I returned, and I picked up enough Russian to put it with bold letters on my CV
That was Russia.
that
Yes.
I'm doing. And I got cast in quite a few films and television programs, as a Russian baddie. They're never good. They're never good.
And you speak German as well from your time in Austria?
Sorry, of course. That's my I don't want to say mother tongue. I suppose father tongue would be the correct.
Your father tongue.
I wouldn't say German is my native language. It's the one I feel most because I was only 3 years old, when I came to Austria, and I yeah.
Yeah, so you, yeah, and it's that Austrian flavored German.
Austrian.
So you get a lot of and that's popular in the theater. I would think that you have theatrical German too. So, Now, as we're talking, you were, you've had this run on the National Theatre. How did that come about?
I got an audition. I mean, I worked there before in 2011. You never know how it comes about, you know. I mean, the agent calls and say, "Hey, you've got a meeting at the National." I'm like, "Cool, you know, that's all I need to know." And give me the script, and I learn my lines, and it was a fantastic, amazing production directed by Stephen Daldry. It's a brand new play by David Lamb, the former artistic director of the Young Vic, and a brilliant playwright, who was in the room every day throughout the rehearsal process. It's all about we're in the Second World War has just ended. We're in the aftermath. In the story takes place in Bavaria, where Ruth, an UNRWA worker, the United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Agency, is trying to sort of locate the homes of, you know, hundreds of thousands of displaced people, and in this case, it's in particular about this 10-year-old boy called Thomas, and you know, throughout this search, they discovered that these horrific events of I think it's called the Lebensborn Project by the Abenomas, you know, which have abducted hundreds of thousands of kids from Eastern Europe to you know to send to sort of camps in Germany and to test their intelligence and their physical abilities, even the measuring their genitals. You know, and if you have like the perfect Aryan looking physical or physically compatible and intelligent young kids, then it will be given to Nazi sort of officer, you know, Nazi party members. It's absolutely sick. But it's a tremendously it's a wonderful play. It's a wonderful, wonderful
Yeah,
play.
it's getting great reviews online. I hope that it gets. I know that some National Theatre productions get broadcast online. Any chance of that or?
Yes, we were filmed by NT Home, so it will be on the it's like the streaming platform for the National Theatre.
Oh.
It will be on them. We've been filmed on the
That's
20th
great.
of October. And fingers crossed, I'm not sure if I'm allowed to say this, but I haven't signed anything contrary to that. So fingers crossed, we might be going to New York
Ooh.
next year because the people
Oh, wow.
The St. Anne's Warehouse in Brooklyn came to see it and they love it and they want it and now it's all, you know, I don't know.
Wow.
Now it's all with the people who are making decisions, I guess.
Merrick, I have to ask, I did a lot of plays in high school and college, and I can assure you the playwrights were never within 1,000 miles of anything that our little productions were doing by any stretch. But having the playwright in the room, that really struck me. Was that comforting and rewarding, or was it just terrifying?
No, it was really, it was not terrifying at all because at the beginning you were like, ooh, you know. But David is such a generous person and he just lets you know, he lets you, it's almost like he discovers it via your interpretation. Because he's been, I also like it because he's been working on this, he had been working on this for I think 10 or 15 years, you know. At some point they wanted to turn it into a movie and then they went back to the original idea of having a theater production. I think him and Stephen, you know, wanted to do this for a long time. And so it was at the beginning, it was quite they're in the room all the time. It was really nice. It was really nice. And he's always open for a chat, for a, you know, answering questions. He's so incredibly knowledgeable and educated and informed about that period, you know, and it was a huge benefit and a joy, really, an absolute joy working with him.
It's wonderful to hear.
And I mean, I would think for him, it's probably a thrill because he's finally seeing this thing that he's been working on for over a decade up on the stage, and you're making part of that possible. So, I would think that you must be seeing him at his happiest, because it's like, this is what I've been waiting for.
Yeah,
Wow.
I hope so, you know.
Well, with the play right there, was there any sense of workshopping is too strong a word, but was he making any changes as he watched you develop it? Was it a collaboration in that sense, or was it just because I know in the theater in general, the script is sacred and you don't deviate from it, you know, that because that's just the way the theater works.
Yeah, very, very much so. Yes, is the answer. And funny you should say workshopping, because the play, they were workshopping this play for I think over like a year or 1.5 years. They had a few sessions. I only me and another actor, Michael Fox, we just joined this summer to. There were 14. There are 13 adult actors and one child actor who's playing young Thomas. And I think the 11 of those actors, and some of them have changed throughout the months. They had been workshopping the play for for 1.5 years, I believe. And so the actors who ended up doing it, you know, most of them were part of this process, said like, oh, this is coming back up. They changed that, they chopped that. Okay, this is coming back. Those characters are coming back. And so it was very fluid by the sounds of it. And even throughout the rehearsal process, dialogue got changed, things got cut, things got added, you know. I think for both David and Stephen to see us, you know, on our feet and working together, and then just seeing the chemistry and the process of the actors, I think, you know, things just made sense, and things didn't make sense, and they were adapting every day. I mean, during the previews, we were literally, I mean, I think we ended up with half an hour less than press night, as we had like a week before on the first preview. It was a brutal process.
Wow. And being able to literally doing that on your feet, it must be you go to bed at night saying lines, I would imagine, in your sleep, just trying to make sure that it's right the next day.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it's it was fast and furious. I mean, the movements, he, you know, we were, I think, over 50 characters between the 14 of us, rolling, and quick changes. You step off stage as the character, you've got 45 seconds to, there's two dressers, you know, with the torch and your costume being ripped apart like Magic Mike, and like put on you. Roll on stage as this character. It was really good fun. Good
Sounds
fun.
wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you don't get run over by the tank, so that's always good too. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, Merrick, thanks so much for being a part of our show. It's in our show, we've noticed on other whenever they do movie, you know, they follow movies and things like that, they're talking to the main stars and things, but there's so many parts, so many moving parts in making a feature film, especially something of the size of Captain America. I mean, anything in the MCU, there's so many people that are involved, and it's always nice to hear what, you know, your piece of it was. I hope somehow they'll find a place for you in a future MCU film. And if not, you know, DC's working hard too. So maybe you can be Jimmy Olsen's roommate or something. We'd like to thank our audience for joining us. If you'd like to continue the conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And please be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
Hang on, are we live? No.
No, no, no.
I can do this all day.